Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Warning, Pastor Scheidbach is not politically correct, and even more shocking, he is a Christian who uses the word God and prays in Jesus' name in public.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach, brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage.
Truth, served here, flavored by delectable wit, delicious sarcasm, succulent sagacity, a gourmet meal for the mind.
My dear friends, let me roll up my sleeves and get my hands around that brain of yours. There we go. Now, let's massage that gray matter muscle getting. There they go. The electrolytes are stimulated and ready to fire. Now I'm going to take a much needed and well-deserved break today. So after I address a few items of interest to you, my faithful and much-beloved brain massage audience, I am going to plug in one of my most famous of all shows, One Nation Under God. Then I'm going to race over, pick up my dove, and we're going to fly off together for a little R&R. First, the budget battles. You know, the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House in September of 2010, right? You remember that? That's the beginning of the fiscal year, and they're supposed to pass a budget. The Democrat-controlled House of Representatives, euphemistically called the Congress, was supposed to pass a budget. They had control of the White House. They had control of both houses of Congress. And by the way, that's the House of Representatives and the Senate. They had it all. Yet they could not pass a budget. Huh? Of course they could have. But they wouldn't. They didn't want to pass a budget. They saw the writing on the wall leading up to the now famous November shellacking and decided to punt. Well, actually, I don't think that's the right analogy. They didn't punt. They purposely fumbled the ball to turn it over to the now Republican-controlled House of Representatives so they could maneuver them into a position to take the fall for the outrageous deficits these Democrats created. Now, this has got to stop. The Tea Party generation must rise up and demand their representatives do not raise the debt ceiling and insist on that meager, and I mean meager, $61 billion in cuts they have proposed, and be the leaders this nation requires right now. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, is the government agency that provides Congress with the information they need to create a budget for the nation. This agency has prepared a preliminary analysis of the president's budget for 2012, and I've looked it over. And quote, deficits in succeeding years under the president's proposals would be smaller than the deficit in 2012, although they would still add significantly to the federal debt, end quote. Now, how do you decrease the deficit while increasing the debt? In case this is not obvious to you, let me run over it. The deficit is the amount we will still owe after all the money we have on hand or can reasonably expect to receive in a fiscal year is spent. And then we borrow against that deficit in order to make ends meet at the end of the year. Now, if you're stupid enough to think you could use borrowed money to inflate your revenues, and then you can fool yourself into thinking you have shrunk the deficit, but you have increased the debt. And if you do this enough times before too long, you can no longer pay the interest on the debt, and, well, you go bankrupt in the real world. Because most of us can't go down into the basement and just print more money until we finally completely capsize the entire economy. Obama's budget is a path to national bankruptcy. Somebody stop this insanity. We need to punish these politicians for behaving the way they do with the future of our children. We need to stand up for our kids and their kids. We must take this government away from these children, these morons. And demand fiscal responsibility. Is there an adult in the House? Quit politicking and start leading. Is there anyone up there who has refused to drink the Kool-Aid of compromise with these insane people? Look, you cannot compromise with insane people. Some maniac steals $1 million from you. And they'll follow this class. He steals $1 million from you. You catch him. You've got him under your power. And then he initiates a negotiation and says, well, how about you give me half of what I stole? Are you kidding me? The Democrats lost the House, and you're going to negotiate with them to let them keep half of what they stole? You don't compromise with evil, and you can't compromise with morons. And you cannot sell our children and their children down the river of national bankruptcy in order to get along with insane people. Is there anyone up there who has not drunk the Kool-Aid of fiscal drunkenness? Spending, laced Kool-Aid. Spending like drunken sailors. We got some Tea Party leaders up there, and they had better not let us down. We have not drunk the Kool-Aid. We sip on the sweet tea of liberty. Thanks, Chris. Now on the Libya matter. Why Libya? Protesters massed in Iran. Innocent civilians were killed by their government while Obama played golf. In Syria, the government was killing protesters while Obama, is making his game chart. The Yemeni government is killing protesters, and Obama, plays some more golf. Or some basketball, got to get out there and do his hoops. Libya breaks into protests, and at first, Obama was too busy playing golf to even make a statement. When he does, he openly declares he's not going to use airstrikes, and he discourages calls for a no-fly zone. What kind of leadership is that? Is this man so dull, a negotiator, that he broadcasts his hand in advance? It's impossible to believe he's that stupid. I'm convinced either he was baiting Mad Dog Gaddafi to sick him, or trying to warn that dog what was coming. But when the UN decides to, at least certainly that was the result of it, by the way. But when the UN decides to call for a no-fly zone in Libya, suddenly Obama says we must step in for humanitarian reasons. And he authorizes airstrikes to enforce a no-fly zone. Exactly what he said before was untenable. Now what is this nonsense all about? Now here's an article. Quote, see what Syria to get for blasting protesters, end quote. Now, I read it just like it was written here. Somebody at WorldNet Daily needs to watch their copy editor more closely. But aside from that, guess what's going on behind the curtain of the most opaque, secretive, lying president America has ever had the misfortune to deal with in the White House? As you know, Syria has had an uprising. Intelligence from Israel, which is pretty reliable, informs us the riots are being instigated by Muslim Brotherhood. So you can expect Obama administration to find some way to use this to advance the cause and interests of the Muslim Brotherhood, right? Now, this gets complicated, class, so listen carefully. The Muslim Brotherhood rises up in protest against Assad. Israel prefers Assad in power to having the Muslim Brotherhood in power, and so they lean on Obama to support Assad. Obama turns to Israel with his broad smile and says, will you give up Golan? And I'll support Assad. In fact, he puts it out there like this. Israel must give up the Golan Heights in order to stabilize Syria. Behind the curtain of the most opaque, secretive liar of a president we've ever had to deal with, the absolute opposite to Abraham Lincoln, my friends, Muslim Brotherhood and Obama are high-fiving one another for another successful move toward the Sharia dominion. So, quote, the White House quietly has been urging Israel and Syria immediately to renew negotiations aimed at an Israeli retreat from the strategic Golan Heights, end quote. Why? Quote, according to informed Middle Eastern security officials, the Obama administration believes an accord with Israel will strengthen the position of Syrian President Bashar Assad, whose regime is threatened by unrest similar to the protests that toppled the leadership of fallen Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, end quote. So, when Syria murders protesters in the streets, Obama does not call in airstrikes. No. Instead, he calls on Israel to give up the strategic Golan Heights. Or he offered that they maybe can lease it from Syria for 30 years. Or in other words, everything this president does advances the cause of the coming Sharia dominion. Listen and watch. The only thing consistent about Obama's foreign policy so far is that in each move, in one way or another, it serves the interests of the Muslim Brotherhood. And now finally on the Constitution. Andy Caldwell, The Andy Caldwell Show here in Santa Maria, and up and down the coast, by the way, interviewed me a while back. I guess you'd call it an interview in a way. I was invited to be his guest on his very good show a while back, and he asked me what I thought was where we need to focus our attention right now in our battle for the soul of America. Or at least that's the way I took his question. And I said we need to protect the Constitution. It's the last standing wall of defense for our liberties. We've lost economic liberty. We're losing the liberties connected to property rights. Our right to bear arms are constantly being eroded. All of this with the Constitution in place to at least slow the power grab of the Democrats. But that Constitution is the only way to get our rights back. And they want to pull us out from under the Constitution altogether. And their attack is becoming very open. I mean, we have people in power who openly advocate for Marxism, whose heroes are murdering Marxists like Pol Pot and Mao Zedong. We have a president whose hatred for the white blood in his veins is matched only by his despite for our Constitution. I mean, start with the birth certificate issue. Show your birth certificate, sir, and go from there. After declaring his view that the president does not have the constitutional power to commit our military force to attack any nation without the declaration of Congress, except in cases of an immediate threat to national security, back when there was concern Bush might attack Iran. Okay. Now he does exactly that. He reverses himself entirely. He spits in the face of our founders. He tramples the Constitution under his feet, and he openly denies our national motto, which, by the way, is "In God We Trust." He says, "E pluribus unum," united we stand. Yeah, he just completely ignorance or absolute contempt for our Constitution way of life. You pick. That's clear to me what it is. He repeatedly undermines the core principles of our way of life expressed in the declaration that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. He misquotes that all the time, leaving out the words creator and created. He has acted in direct violation of the Constitution of the United States, and you do nothing. I'm telling you that the last line of defense of our liberties is the Constitution that Obama is assaulting. The Soros wrecking ball that is called Obama is slamming into the last wall of defense for our liberties. If it falls, this entire nation falls with it. We'd better stop him now. All right, I got to go spend some time with the Dove. That's my wife, by the way. After this short break, I'm going to play some excerpts of my most famous of all shows, One Nation Under God. And if you want a complete copy of that show, send me some money to pay for our radio airtime. All right, I'm playing with you. Look, if you have been put out of work by Obama and his Kool-Aid-drinking Democrats with their illegal moratorium on offshore drilling, while at the same time he sends billions to Brazil to help their economy and develop their offshore drilling capabilities, well, you call in and I'll instruct my staff to send you the CD, One Nation Under God, for free. But if you can squeeze out a fiver or a tenner or 20 or more, do it for the cause. All right, God bless you. God save America. I'll see you in church.
I have written melodies for several of the Psalms, and I'm gratified that so many have enjoyed singing them. We've produced a CD titled Singing Psalms. $10 covers the cost of the CD and includes a $3 donation to our ministry. Call 1-888-770-8000 to order yours today. Or go to www.santamarialighthouse.org and click on the bookstore button. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through this night by your light from above. That prayer rose up to heaven from almost every heart in America following 9/11. We must never forget the lessons of that awful day. They say as many as 50 suicide attacks were planned. Miraculously, only 3 were successfully launched. Consider for a moment the symbolic significance of these 3 targets. The World Trade Center is clearly a symbol of our economic might. The Pentagon is a symbol of our military might, and the White House, a symbol of the only nation on earth which was founded upon the belief that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Our founding fathers depended upon the protection of divine providence. They knew we needed God's blessing. But as anyone paying attention can see, many Americans have turned to other gods. The love of money is the root of all evil, the Bible says, and it's called the god of mammon. Remember, morality does not matter, character does not count. It's the economy, stupid. Many Americans have naively trusted something the Bible calls the god of forces, believing that our military might alone would deter anyone from attacking us. But 9/11 changed all that. The god of mammon was slapped when the towers fell, and the god of forces was tweaked on the nose. But the White House, symbol of our God-given rights, was protected by some God-fearing patriots on Flight 93. Here is a lesson from 9/11 you don't hear much about. As we turn away from the god of our forefathers, we will become increasingly vulnerable to terrorists and tyrants. Nonetheless, traditional God-fearing patriotism is being assaulted on every side. Hundreds of examples could be cited, but there is one that is developing right now in our courts, and I think it perfectly reflects what is happening in our country generally. The Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco ruled the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. Why? Because it includes the expression, under God. Is the court simply being consistent with the notion of separation of church and state? Or Is this another step out from under the protection of divine providence our forefathers depended upon when founding this nation? The court's ruling has brought out into the open the most important question facing Americans today. Is America one nation under God? Is America one nation under God? In the Bible, God says, "Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord." Can we be reasonable about this? Our court used to think differently than it does today. In 1892, Supreme Court Justice Josiah Brewer wrote the unanimous opinion in a case called Holy Trinity, in which he said that in, quote, American life, as expressed by its laws, its business, its customs, and its society, we find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth, that this is a Christian nation. And friend, this goes to the heart of our discussion. You see, the secularists want to remove all expressions of Christian influence from our laws, our business, our customs, and our society. But what did our founding fathers have to say? Recently, the University of Houston concluded a 10-year study in which 15,000 documents of our American heritage were compiled and compared, and it was shown they quoted the Bible more than any other source. George Washington said it was impossible to govern without God and the Bible, and that every patriot should be a Christian. At the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin said, "I have lived a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." And Patrick Henry reminded all the delegates that America was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ. And yet, godless secularists display a shocking arrogance when they accuse our founders of using God talk merely to manipulate the people to support their effort to create a secular government. Those who make this charge are guilty of reproaching the memory of the dead who are conveniently no longer here to defend themselves. They cast an evil slur upon the character of good men for their own gain. They are guilty of slander against the heroes of freedom, liberty, justice, who paid the price for our liberty. Nonetheless, even the most skeptical secularists will have to admit this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. You see, their scandalous lie about the framers rests upon an admission regarding the people. We, the people of early America, were overwhelmingly Christian, any way you look at it. America was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ, just like Patrick Henry said. This does not mean every American was a Christian. Nonetheless, it cannot be denied that Christian beliefs and values served as the foundation on which our founders constructed this government. Every honest student of history must see that our nation was started by people who identified themselves with the Christian faith, and that our laws are built upon the Bible. And so our coins say, "In God we trust." And so our pledge declares, "We are one nation under God." Our history declares it to be so. To what conclusion does an honest regard for history compel us? We are one nation under God. And while I am sensible of the many blessings this has afforded us, I am also sensible of the great danger we face in forsaking the God of our fathers. We cannot destroy the foundation upon which our liberties rest without toppling the liberties that rest upon it. Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble when I reflect that God is just." Well, I also tremble when I consider that as a nation, we are scorning what the founders feared to be without, the protection of divine providence. Dial 911 to your memories, operator. Perhaps you're thinking, doesn't our Constitution require the separation of church and state? Come now, let us reason together. The First Amendment provides for 6 laws that protect our most cherished rights. The prohibition against the establishment of religion, which is called the Establishment Clause, together with a provision guaranteeing the equal entitlement of the free exercise of religion, which is called the Free Exercise Clause. A provision guaranteeing free speech, together with a provision guaranteeing a free press, and a provision guaranteeing the right to peaceable assembly and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Did you ever notice that all of these are grouped together in one amendment? It is one sentence and it addresses one subject, and that subject is liberty. It was through a great travail for religious liberty that the First Amendment was given birth and amended to our Constitution. Consider the birth of the First Amendment. In May of 1776, a convention met in Virginia in which the grandfather of our Bill of Rights was drafted. It was called the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Some objections were raised against the use of the word tolerance in the religious liberty clause. You see, the Baptists, represented in that meeting by their friend James Madison, believed their right to free exercise did not come from an edict of toleration. They wanted it clearly understood that their religious liberty came from God, and on that ground was unalienable. After much debate, James Madison won the following language, which satisfied all in the assembly. Quote, "All men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion." The public debate that gave birth to the First Amendment was not over freedom from religion, but freedom of religion. So where did this idea of separation of church and state come from? Perhaps you have heard about Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, where he used the expression "wall of separation between church and state." But have you had the opportunity to read that letter for yourself? Jefferson was not talking about restricting the influences of religion in our government. He was assuring those concerned Baptists that the Constitution prohibited any church from using the powers of government to restrict the free exercise of others. For over 150 years, every case in our courts was ruled on the basis that the First Amendment protected the freedom of religion. Nevertheless, in 1948, the court started interpreting the Establishment Clause as though it was meant to prohibit the government from endorsing or encouraging the Christian religion. The result has been that the Establishment Clause is today interpreted in such a manner that it contradicts the Free Exercise Clause. But this contradicts the Founders' purpose. It contradicts 156 years of case law, and it is contrary to the simple wording of the amendment. The language of the First Amendment says, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." The word "or" shows us that both these clauses were to work together to achieve the same end, religious liberty. To lift the Establishment Clause out of its context and use it to violate the Free Exercise Clause is outrageous. These lawyers and judges attempt to use the language of the Constitution to defeat the very liberties it was written to protect. So, what is the Establishment Clause all about? Remember that the Constitution and Bill of Rights were birthed in an historical context of a culture that was essentially Christian in its beliefs and values. The Establishment Clause was intended to prohibit any particular Christian sect from using the power of government to interfere with the religious liberty of others. But this will only work for a society which is essentially Christian in its morals and values. All laws are the extension of the collective values and beliefs of a community, which is why lawmaking in America is assigned to our representatives in Congress, and it's not supposed to be done in the courtrooms. Let me illustrate for you why our founders so often said that our Constitution is inadequate to govern irreligious people, and why they believed Christianity was the only religion that would support the liberties we cherish. I'm sure we all can agree, murder is immoral, and so we have laws against murder. Suppose we continue down the road to paganizing our society to the point that some nut argues her religious beliefs are violated by our laws against murder. How? Well, human sacrifice is part of her religious beliefs, let's say. She wants to be sacrificed to her pagan god without exposing the officiating priest to a charge of murder. Of course, now, we would consider such a group to be a dangerous cult. You see, our laws against murder are understood within the context of our culture. Obviously, the framers constructed our government within the context of a Christian culture, and our Constitution will not survive in the hands of a people who are not essentially Christian in their values and beliefs. Christianity has traditionally been encouraged in America for the simple reason that it was the cultural force that created the government in the first place. So when George Washington encouraged every patriot to aspire to be a good Christian, he was not establishing religion. He was encouraging Christian morality with the full understanding that without it, our system of government could not long endure. This court's recent ruling is contrary to our history. It is contrary to early case law. It is contrary to the Bill of Rights. It doesn't even make legal sense. One principle of legal interpretation is that if the consistent application of a law leads to absurd results, it's bad law. Well, consider, of our nation's founding documents, none is more precious to us than the Declaration of Independence. However, application of this law would require us to ban the Declaration of Independence from our public schools. Why? Well, consider all this unconstitutional religious terminology. Like, quote, the laws of nature and of nature's God, end quote. And these that warm every American heart, quote, all men are created equal, end quote. And, quote, all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, end quote. And in this official document of state, you have the entire legislative body of the Continental Congress declaring they are, quote, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world, end quote. And by the way, they were not talking about the Supreme Court justices. And then, Thomas Jefferson, who was charged with the responsibility to phrase the collective sentiments of the Congress, concluded this document saying they proceeded, quote, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, end quote. A protection, mind you, we have scorned and spurned and have lately begun to lose. Dial 911 to your memory's operator. See those towers crushing down upon Manhattan. If the pledge is unconstitutional, we must conclude the Declaration of Independence is unconstitutional. And I certainly hope that's absurd to you. Jessica Reeves writes for Time magazine, and she would have us know that some lawyers agree with the notion that, quote, in the strictest reading of the Constitution, there is no room for religious terminology in what should be a secular space, end quote. Did you know there was a space in America where your religious liberties have no constitutional protection? It doesn't make you a bit edgy to think our courts can arbitrarily create a space where they can suspend constitutionally protected rights? Come now, let us reason together. Does it not follow? If our courts can suspend one of our unalienable rights, it can also suspend others? Are any of our rights safe in the hands of this court? Why do some want to destroy the only foundation our forefathers believed would support our liberty? Different people and groups have different reasons. Some have been offended by individual Christians, perhaps with good reason. Not all Christians honor the name. Some are offended at the intolerance and bigotry that has been exhibited at certain times in history by so-called Christian institutions. May I emphasize the expression so-called? Some are offended by what the Bible says on the subject of hellfire, or sin nature, or abortion, or sodomy. But generally, folks are not aggressively campaigning to push religion out of public life only because they disagree with it. To understand the aggressive, even the fanatical opponents of God-fearing patriotism, it's helpful to distinguish ideological opponents and sociological opponents. Ideological opponents are those whose beliefs and values are contrary to traditional American ideals and beliefs. These despise our form of government, and I think rightly understand that Christianity is their primary obstacle to their effort to convert America into a godless socialist state. Incoming, blinding missile of insight right at your head. But don't duck, listen up. That's what the communists in Russia thought. That's what the communists in China think today. Secular nations have never been friendly to freedom. Sociological opponents of conservative Christianity come from among those whose lifestyle is condemned by the morals and values of our Christian culture. We are engaged in a new civil war, and the battle is for the hearts and minds of our children, and it's not fought with bullets and cannon, but with words and laws. And my friend, you'd better get enlisted. Your liberty is at risk. Godless regimes have never been a friend to civil liberty. Call me, my friends, and leave a message on our listener response hotline. It's a free call to anyone within the continental United States from outside the country, or those who prefer it. You can email me by going to our website and clicking on the Contact Us button, thebrainmassageshow.com. God bless you. God save America. I'll see you in church.